I like the program beats. Diamond D is out. I wanna say pay. Show biz, there's deals to make. So let's get busy and dig in the crates.
I don't stop. You keep on digging in the crates.
Let's get busy.
Keep on
digging in the crates.
Welcome everybody to the first 2016 edition of Digging in the Crates podcast. I'm your host Phil Schneider. I took a little hiatus, but now I'm back, and we got a great show for everyone today, for a refreshing the memory. The conceit of this podcast is we're kind of constructing an old school Schneider Cop tape via podcast. So I'm kind of pulling out some matches that sort of a little bit under the radar, a little bit less known, but great matches. I'm having a guest and me watch them, and then we're going to talk about them. My guest today is Childs Walker, my buddy. How you doing, Childs?
Doing well. How's things?
Good. This is your second podcast, right?
Ever? No, it's more than my second podcast ever. But I hadn't done any for a long time, and then I did those super marathon one for Greatest Wrestler Ever with Loss.
How long were those?
that was a little bit more than 9 hours, and we did it overnight, which was sort of insane.
So you did a 9 hour podcast in one sitting?
Yes, we started at about 10 p.m. and finished about a little bit after 7.
What did you? You're a married guy, Charles, right?
Yes, I'm an adult.
So you're an adult married guy. You've got kids
and stuff.
Plural kids, right?
Yes, two.
Okay. How did your wife feel about you recording a 9 hour overnight wrestling podcast?
Well,
how did that go over?
My wife sort of assumes as a default that I'm ridiculous, so it went over okay. I mean, she just sort of rolls her eyes at that, like she rolls her eyes at many things. So
my wife also thinks I'm ridiculous. That's an interesting coincidence. who thought that? My wife also, her default is also that I'm ridiculous.
I mean, she and I have been together for 20 years now, so I mean, there are not a lot of secrets dwelling
you have nothing you need to be ashamed of at this point.
I've shamed myself about as much as I possibly can already. So,
okay. Well, the next time I have 9 hours free, I'll have to listen to that podcast.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, Loss has kids too, so it was one of those things where it was kind of the only time we could do that. As stupid as that sounds, but
this is not going to go 9 hours.
No, this will be a nice
get this in on
by comparison.
a quick 115 maybe is what I'm shooting for here today. So let's just jump right into the first match. Let's do this in chronological order. And that means our first match is going to be Nick Bockwinkel versus Ricky Morton from July 2nd, 1982, Houston Wrestling, from our friends at NWA Classics, the single coolest thing that's happened to professional wrestling fandom for I can't remember how long. A kind of a dream match I don't think that I knew happened. So it wasn't like a match that I'd be like, oh, man, I've always wanted to see that Nick Bockwinkel, Ricky Morton, AWA title match. I didn't know that those guys ever wrestled each other for the AWA title until NWA Classic posted this match. But it was pretty fun to see. What did you think of this? What was your general initial impressions?
Well, like you, I was pretty surprised that Ricky Morton was even wrestling for the AWA championship at that point in his career. I agree with you. That's sort of nothing I would have even conceived of. I thought, you know, in broad strokes, I didn't think it was a blowaway match. I didn't think it ever got to that extraordinary level, but it was sort of a very solid second tier title match that showed off some of the things that you like about both of those guys. So, I mean, I certainly found it satisfying. I didn't think it was, say, one of the top 10 or 15 matches that we've seen on NWA Classics, but it was certainly something that I was glad existed.
Yeah, I think I'm sort of along those lines. I mean, I think it's one of those things that there's just not a ton of Nick Bockwinkel AWA title matches. There's some, but that's when you compare them, for example, the amount of Ric Flair NWA title matches we have, it's a much smaller group, and it's really cool to watch him work this kind of match where you've got Ricky Morton isn't even Ricky Morton in 86 or 87 when he had those Flair matches? Was it 86?
Yeah, I think 86.
86, right? That's 4 years later. That's Ricky Morton as part of the Rock and Roll Express, which was a hot, really hot act. This is Ricky Morton well before that, as sort of, and he really is almost a little like a Ric Flair versus Sam Houston kind of thing, where like Morton is clearly a guy not that Nick Bockwill is expecting to have an easy day with. So it's kind of funny. Nick Bockwill is a guy who's really great at sort of portraying sort of patrician contempt.
And he really wrestles the match that way too. I mean, I think the whole it's a 2 out of 3 falls match, yeah. And I think the whole story of the first fall is essentially Nick Bockwinkel wrestling Morton as if he does have contempt for him, and Morton kind of continually showing him up for that. I mean, that was kind of the dynamic that I saw them establish early on. I thought they did a really good job with that.
Yeah, like Bockwinkel would have been an amazing like member of the country club in Caddyshack. You know what I mean? Or like the dean of the college that Rodney Dangerfield goes to in Back to School. Like, you know what I mean? Just like, look at this. Like, I am just disgusted by this entire situation. And you can tell he's like, why am I even bothering wrestling's kid? And then when like Ricky Morton starts to catch him here, catch him there, you can see Bockwinkel get even more frustrated.
And it's perfect too, because Morton, as much as Morton looked like a hayseed in sort of the heyday of the Rock and Roll Express, he looked like even more of a hayseed at this point. I mean, his hair was incredible. And I mean, Ricky Morton always had one of the all-time great wrestling mullets, but I think that this was even you know, skeezier on somehow. Like he had like a helmet head thing going on top, and then the mullet. I mean, it was
yeah, he really did look like a guy who would run a carnival ride.
and maybe he was at that point. Who knows?
Probably what that really is his vibe in that match. So that was, this kid who runs the carnival ride is somehow in a wrestling match with a vice president of a bank. the one thing I thought took from it a little bit was there's a lot of the matches Ricky Morton working over Bockwinkel's leg and then putting on a figure four, and then the first figure four he puts on, he absolutely does not apply correctly.
No, he didn't. he didn't even put the leg over to apply the pressure at the
end. And it's like, oh man, I've it was in way too many Ric Flair inspired wrestling matches in my middle school to not how to know how to correctly apply a figure.
Exactly.
Four.
We've all put on the figure four, right? I mean, yeah, come on.
That was my only real flaw with the work in the match. Otherwise I thought Bockwinkel was great in this. God.
Well, and the great thing about Bockwinkel is, because I mean, you said it earlier, he comes off as the arrogant bank president, but then he's a tough son of a bitch, right? I mean, like, yeah. when it's time to kick your ass, he'll kick your ass.
Yeah, there's one point where he kind of just leans down and just sort of hooks Ricky Morton right in the mouth.
Yep.
That was just like, oh, God. I don't really remember Bockwinkel as a guy who's going to, you know, be really this violent. But he's a guy who could be really violent.
And the pile driver to end the first fall, pretty violent.
Yeah, that pile driver was a great pile driver.
Yeah.
And Ricky Morton sort of, you know, working with the, I'm not sure if I can feel all my arms and legs, and my neck is really messed up. I don't know. The more I talk about this match, the kind of more I like it.
You're talking yourself into it.
What? It's kind of really selling myself on this match. Because when I watched it, I was like, ooh, this is really cool. I mean, that's the really great thing about it. I mean, I think every episode of this podcast has at one point I've stopped and waxed about how much I love NWA classics. But just that so much of this stuff is like, you know, here are these two guys you didn't know really ever had a feud in, and here's this really amazing match they had with each other. And that, you know, Houston is historically pre-Mid-South, is this promotion I just didn't know anything about. So they got lots of these feuds and wrestlers in there that I just had no idea this stuff even existed.
Well, and Houston, well, the other great thing about Houston is they seem to have brought together all these people that you never thought of coming together, right? I mean, they're drawing from all these different sources that you always thought of as separate, and then you end up with a matchup like this, where, as you said, you would never even would have thought that it might have occurred, right? I mean, it's two guys from different worlds, essentially.
Yeah, there's a really, really great – I don't know if you watched the Tully Blanchard and Mil Máscaras match yet.
I did, yeah. I did. Yeah,
it's like, who knows that? Who knew that was a thing that existed? Those guys apparently had a vicious blood feud. You know, that was apparently – you know, if that was something that was on, you know, TV, you know, NWA or AWA or in a promotion that got covered by wrestling magazines, I mean, that would have been like a – seemed like maybe a legendary feud, the Mil Máscaras versus Tully Blanchard feud, and I'd never heard of it, and it was just great.
Well, right, and as a result, we're seeing all these guys – I mean, their careers are sort of being built out for us almost, right? I mean, yeah. You know, Blanchard is one example. I mean, we've talked a lot about Gino Hernandez. Obviously, Jose Lothario has been kind of the star of the whole thing. But even a guy like Morton, I mean, you talked about us not having a ton of Bockwinkle title matches, but, I mean, we don't have a ton of Morton singles matches, right?
Right.
I mean, a little bit for Memphis, the Flair stuff, but, I mean, there's not a ton.
And, like, an occasional, like, Ricky Morton versus Stan Lane, like, singles. Ricky Morton versus, right. You know, Manny Fernandez or something like that. That's a singles, two singles matches as part of a tag feud, which is a very different kind of match.
Yes.
Like those matches, when those matches are just 7 minutes before both teammates run in and punch each other, they're worked in a very specific style, which isn't this. This is him working like a 2 out of 3 falls world title match in the, and you know, it's like the Ricky Morton world title matches we had had previously are all amazing. And this is like really another example of like, okay, he could do this against somebody besides just Flair.
And the fans were really with him too. I mean, they had the crowd into it, you know, especially as the match went on.
Yeah, Heenan was really fun. I mean, it was nifty. I mean, I'm hoping we get more Bockwinkle. I mean, I think if it's clear that Bockwinkle was coming to Houston, so that means hopefully there's Bockwinkle Gino or Bockwinkle Lothario or Al Madrill or something, or like some other sort of that era Bockwinkle matches that'll still show up, because I mean, he's a guy that, you know, every time I watch him, I wish I had all of his stuff.
And it does sound like there's at least the possibility of a lot of that stuff, right? I mean, just from looking at the cards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. NWA Classics.
Also, Morton, just talking about the end of the match, Morton also took a nutty bump to set up the finish. That crazy thing where he just sort of threw himself akimbo into the ropes.
I thought it was a little like here's a bump I'm about to take. I don't know exactly understand the physics of how the thing that happened to him had that happen.
But it really looks like it hurt.
It did have a little bit of a Kurt Hennig-ish feel to it, where it's just like, you know, you kicked me in my arm and I'm gonna fly and smash my head into this thing, and it doesn't make exact sense. But yeah, everybody should go watch that match if they've got NWA Classics. And if you don't have NWA Classics, you should go buy NWA Classics. And there's like 15 matches you should watch before this one, but then you should watch this one.
If you're listening to this, but you don't have NWA Classics, what are you doing with your life?
Yeah, it seems really weird. It seems really weird that you would listen to me talk about – that you would be the – whatever the tiny audience of this podcast is, but not – you'd be willing to spend your time listening to us talk about this, but not be willing to spend $9 to watch this stuff. All right, so let's keep moving time-wise, and let's go on to El Hijo de Santo, Negro Casas versus Scorpio Jr., and Bestia Salvaje, Hair and Mask versus Hair and Mask from March 19th, 1999. Had this a match that you'd seen before?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Had you seen it any time recently, or had you seen it in, like, 1999?
No. I had probably seen it when I first started watching Santo, which at this point probably would be 7 or 8 years ago that I really, you know, dug into him. Probably saw it then for the first time, and then saw it more recently going through the 99 yearbook. So I mean, I had actually seen it pretty recently. So this was just sort of a refresher watch. Okay. And this is not a match that you have to talk yourself into. This is a blowaway great match, I think.
Yeah, unbelievable. I mean, we know Negro Casas is, you know, the at worst the sixth or seventh best wrestler of all time. El Hijo de Santo is El Hijo de Santo, but I mean, I think one thing this really is sort of the, you know, career performances from Scorpio Jr. and Bestia Salvaje, who have kind of very workman-like CMLL Rudos in like the 90s. And right. This is the point where they get, like you'd expect, this is the point where they're losing their hair and their masks to two of the greatest wrestlers of all time. And at no point did they feel like passengers on this journey. Right? I mean, they came out and they...
No, they didn't.
They were amazing in this, both of them.
They were. And I guess one of the great things about this was not one of those sort of thrown together hair and mask situations. I mean, they had been building to this one way or another for, what, more than a year, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was kind of built right around the time Santo turned heel.
Yeah, I mean, it flowed out of that. That's right.
So that was 97, right? So this was like almost 2 years built for this.
And he teamed with those guys for a while as a Rudo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bestie and Scorpio, possibly the ugliest tag team in wrestling history. Scorpio obviously gets unmasked. You know how ugly he is after he takes the mask off. But as a tag team, those two guys...
There's a lot of competition there, but yeah, I could see that.
just great grizzled, messed up, you know, like the kind of people that would play dock workers in movies in the 50s. Just jacked faced dudes who just Bestia. I may have even told this story before on a podcast, but when I did a play by play commentary on a Lucha pilot in Monterey. Probably not that far away from this period. I think it was right around 99. It might have been 2000. Like Bestia Live was one of those guys who just blew me away with his charisma. Like he started for some reason booking his own angle with Champagne, who was doing Flame of Color with me. Like he kind of like kept like, you know, like shoving the table and getting in his face for no real reason. So that's like the great. Hair versus hair match that never happened. Bestia Savai versus Champagne, which I mentioned was amazing. And when he just came out, he just like live up close. He was just insanely violent.
Omega wasn't willing to put the bill to bring Bestia
Savai
to North Carolina.
didn't last past that, unfortunately, or I would have fervently pushed for it. but live, he was just one of those guys. Like he came off. Him and like Satanico were like the two guys live that were just like, man, these guys in a small room, random gymnasium somewhere in Monterey, under sketchy circumstances, are just killing it here.
Yeah.
And here it was just like, just, and this is like, you don't really see that much anymore in wrestling, right? Because there's not blood anymore, hardly in any major promotion. This is and wrestling is just so much more produced than it was then, and certainly years before. This felt grittier than anything you're really going to see. I can't think of a situation where you're going to see this again. That would be this big in the sense of huge stars in a sold out big arena and feel this sort of gritty.
No, this match couldn't happen now, and I mean I don't know if you agree with this, and I know a lot of people really don't, but I really feel like we've lost something in the Apuestas matches, the big Apuestas matches now. I mean, they're always going to feel hugely important, you know, especially if you have a famous mask like Atlantis on the line. But without the blood and the grit, it's just not the same to me.
No, it's very produced. I still like them.
Sure,
you got to become matches as any. Ever has that much like actual emotion.
I mean, it still carries a drama and a stakes that you're not going to find in any other setting, but it's just not the same thing.
No, it's much cleaner. You know what I mean? It's the difference in the way movies were in the 80s than in the 70s.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's the difference between Rocky 1 and Rocky 4. In the way that this sort of they feel now. They feel very much like moments produced to dig emotion and less organic, less violent. I mean, they just aren't. Every once in a while this stuff will show up in smaller arenas and, you know, on Black Terry Jr. handhelds and things like that.
Yeah.
But never for this, never in this way that it means this much. Never in the way that it's El Hijo Asano putting his mask up, Nico Casas putting his hair up. Scorpio Jr., who's the son of a huge star and a big star in his own right, losing his mask in a way that's going to be done where just blood is just spraying all over the ring, and Negro Casas needs to give himself like a head tourniquet to stop from bleeding. You know, like that kind of thing. Negro Casas is a guy who doesn't even really bleed. I mean, I can't really think of a number of other times I've seen him really bleed. And in this match, he's bleeding so badly that at one point he starts ripping off what, a bandana? What was he ripping off? Part of his trunks? I'm trying to remember. I know at one point he sort of fashions MacGyver style, like a head wrap.
Yeah, he tied something around his head. I'm not sure where he got it from, but yeah, I mean he had the full Revolutionary War soldier tying your head together thing. I mean it was something. But I mean I guess everybody was great in this match, but it was also a great reminder of how amazing Santo is in a blood and guts match. I mean, you know, we sort of know that, but it's not how he gets talked about a lot. I mean, people talk about the, you know, the beauty of what he does and the consistency and the professionalism and all that stuff. And that's all true, but God damn, is he good, you know, in these kinds of settings where, you know, the mask gets ripped open and, you know, he's bleeding through the white and the silver and, You really believe he's fighting for something, right? Even though you kind of know on some level he's never going to lose, you feel it.
Yeah, no, he's amazing at it. I mean, he's great at almost all the different roles that he plays, which is why he's such a great wrestler, right? I mean, he is great as a guy running through his cool shit in a trios match, he's great as a guy working a mat with somebody in that kind of match, and he's great in this kind of match where he's got to, you know. He's got to take all that prettiness and use it for ugly me in an ugly way. Because he does it. He's a beautiful dive in this match, right? Right.
But he hit his big dives. I mean, he hit all his big dives like he always does. But he did them, as he often does, he did them in kind of really organic ways.
Yeah.
You know, where it didn't feel like it was built to some huge setup for the dive. I mean, he would sort of hit it out of nowhere where it looked like the Rudo wasn't quite ready to take it. I mean, you know, it felt like part of the same ragged, crazy fight that the rest of the match was.
Yeah. And that's one of the really great things about Santos dives is they don't require catching really.
Right.
That's the thing I like about a great tope is a great tope doesn't really need to be caught.
Nope.
Whereas like there are other, you know, other things that are really fancy, but they need a guy to just kind of stand there and, you know, wait around and look up in the sky where Aerostar does 5 springboards. Where Santo comes at you like a dart, and you don't need to stand there and look like you're waiting for somebody to dive on you.
Right, right.
I love the part where the one ref stops the other ref from after the foul, where that could have, that was all of a sudden you were gonna, Lando was gonna lose his mask on a cheap shot. That was cool.
Yeah, no, that was great. And look, I mean, Casas was brilliant in this match, sort of riling up the crowd at ringside. I mean, he was in all his glory. And of course we're used to seeing him do that as a Rudo, and here he's paired up with his lifelong rival, doing it as a Technico, and you know it's no different. I mean, he's just a genius at that stuff.
Yeah, and you know he is. And although we're used to him doing it as a Rudo, I mean, when was the last time he's really been a Rudo?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I mean, he's been pretty much a Technico, like a rule breaking Technico for like a long time at this point.
I mean, at this point, yeah, I guess.
I guess he doesn't. It's hard to. I mean, even when he was a Rudo in the 90s in Arena Mexico, he was still, it's hard for people to dislike him.
Yeah.
You know, he's always been a little like Austin, I think. In Mexico, almost, where it's just like, you know, he'll just do Rudo-ish things, but it does not matter. You're gonna cheer. I remember this is another sort of live thing. I remember watching him in a trios match the one time I went to Arena Mexico, where he wasn't the focal point of the match at all. The focal point of the match was the other guys, but it was like you couldn't stop watching him, even if other people were wrestling. Like, your focus was just on Negro Casas. Like, everybody else could be doing cool stuff. Great wrestlers doing cool stuff. I think Santo was in that match. I think Mystico was in that match. I don't remember exactly. But you're just, I'm going to watch Negro Casas on the apron. You know, I'm going to watch him, like, talk trash to somebody else or interact with an old lady in the film. Your focus is on him no matter what else is going on. I mean, when you're watching him live, he's that electric, even when surrounded by other all-time great electric wrestlers.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he's the best. Where did you have him on your greatest wrestler of all time list?
I actually had him lower. I had him in the 40s.
Oh, my God.
He's never been my very favorite lucha guy.
Would this match have moved you up eight spots if we had rewatched this right before we put the list together?
I don't know. Maybe a few, but I mean, it's not like I didn't know this match existed.
That's true.
It's not like I'm not aware of him being great at the stuff he was great at in this match. I mean, I am. To me, he doesn't connect on the level of Santo or Dandy or Satanico. I see the charisma, but I don't always see the same skill and grit in the actual wrestling. Not that he's not good at the actual wrestling, but I don't know. I get sucked in with those other guys more than him.
It's your fault.
Yes.
I think he was my number two.
Yeah, you had him way high.
So, you know, okay, I think I had him right behind Lawler. I could even see an argument about switching those two.
Yeah.
I mean, after this match, I kind of wanted to go, oh, maybe I should have switched those two. Lawler's going to get plenty of votes. So let's move on to our third match. Is it Nobutaka Araya and Toshiaki Kawada versus Masafuchi and Genichiro Tenryu? I think I got those right. How did that go?
Close enough.
From June 30th, 2001. Is this a match you'd seen before?
Yes.
Okay. What did you think of it? Didn't care for it?
No, I liked it. I don't know that it's a blowaway great match. I mean, I don't think it's anywhere near the level of the Lucha match that we just talked about. But what it is, so it's a great Tenryu performance, and it's a great example of what Tenryu can do with sort of a lower ranked guy, while still being a badass. You know, he kind of made Araya seem like a tough guy, right?
I mean, sure.
You know, that was sort of the spine of the match to me. I mean, you know, I thought Fuchi and Kawada were both fine in the match, but I didn't think either one of them gave one of their really high end performances in it. So for me, this match came down to what Tenryu could do with Araya, and that really did click for me. And then I guess the other good thing about it is that, you know, in the context of 2000s Japanese work, it's rare to see a match that you would be happy to see go 5 minutes longer. Usually you want it to be 5 minutes shorter.
Sure. that's a good point. You know, I mean, I don't know. I love Fuchi and Tenryu as sadistic prison guards torturing a guy.
Sure. But I thought this was actually a fairly modest Fuchi performance on that front. I mean, Fuchi has a real deep sadism.
You didn't really see. I mean, he was hitting him with that bloody nose.
You saw some of it here, but I didn't think I've seen Fuchi get way more sadistic than this.
Yeah. I mean, I loved the punch that broke his nose.
Yes. That's what sort of set off the whole match.
Yeah. That was so great. It was just like such an asshole move by Tenryu.
I mean, you know, the match sort of started with some fine work between Fuchi and Kawada, and those guys have worked with and against each other for forever. And so, you know, they just kind of do some of their stuff, and it's fine. But then Tenryu busts Araya's nose, and that sort of sets everything off, right? And that's the beauty of Tenryu.
Yeah. It was really, really – Tenryu unprofessionally mauling a guy is one of my favorite wrestling things. But like where Tenryu decides that I mean, Araya's like, wouldn't you assume Araya's like a friend of his? They seem to always follow each other to promotions.
Yeah, probably. Years.
So he just decided, oh, I'm gonna, you know, whatever his tag match, I'm just gonna break my friend's nose and then like punch him in his broken nose a bunch until he bleeds all over the ring and then make him a superstar. Like I don't know. It was the time in a different time. This match would have like made Araya,
right?
Right? This had been a 5 years earlier in All Japan, right? Than when it was, where All Japan was already kind of dying and fracturing. And I mean, that match would have made Araya. That would have been Araya. Araya would have been a star forever.
Yeah.
This thing. And Araya's not that great. Like, out of your, like, war dudes, he's fine.
But no, he's just a guy.
he's not Takeshi Ishikawa.
But, I mean, that's the, that's one of the great underrated beauties of Tenryu is that he makes guys like that look great over and over and over for two decades.
Yeah, it really is. It's one of the reasons I had Tenryu so high when we were talking a little about this countdown thing, because it's something that's just happened over pro wrestling only. We both did it. And one of the reasons I had Tenryu so high is he had all these opportunities to do. He didn't work the same five awesome dudes for 20 years, right? He worked, Tarzan Goto, and he worked matches like this, and he worked Takada and other scrubs like that, and made them look awesome. And this was a real example of him sort of taking a guy who's fine, who's probably a little better than Ishii and not nearly as good as Hara in your whist of war heavyweights, would be where I put Araya.
And yeah, I guess that's about right.
Yeah, kind of, made him look like an absolute
lower middle class. Yeah. Kind of lower middle class.
Yeah, exactly. Right, he's fine. Like he never did anything like him. He had actually come when he's. And there's never been an Araya match that wasn't opposite Tenryu that has been anything like this. But I mean, this was awesome. Honestly, it really is just the idea. And you're right. I don't know. This wasn't the most sadistic Fuchi. Performance, but man, would I have loved a long run of a Fuchi Tenryu tag team Japan and America, just running through and how amazing would a Fuchi Tenryu team been managed by Tojo Yamamoto in Memphis?
Which is funny because and of course they were in the 80s, they were always on opposite sides,
right?
So we really never did get that.
In the 90s too, right? I mean, obviously that there was a bunch of big matches where Fuchi – this match, I think, happened a bunch of times with the team switch. This is almost like a weird, like, Parejas match, right?
Yeah.
Guy and war guy versus all Japan guy and war guy.
Well, it wouldn't have been in the 90s though, right? It would have been in the 2000s.
Would have been in the 2000s, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, these guys had no contact with Tenryu in the 90s.
Right. But you're right. But in other points, I think earlier, this year, I think this match happened in other way with the teams the way they kind of should be.
No, that's right. I mean, normally you would expect Kawada and Fuchi to be together. You mentioned the greatest wrestler ever thing, and I've tried not to be horrified by too much of what's happened in the rankings, but I was a little horrified to see Tenryu drop before the top 10.
Yeah.
And see 20 people just not vote for him at all. That was a little hard to take.
I think that is a project that has been sufficiently
covered. Yeah, we don't need to adjudicate that.
That's a war that's been fought again and again and again. But
no, that's
that is something you get when you have 150 people voting and 25 people participating.
But how can you not love Tenryu?
Yeah, he's the best. Was there ever a point in your early period of wrestling internet, at what point did you start tape trading and collecting and in existing in an internet wrestling space?
Yeah, I came in later than most of you guys. I mean, I came in
because we're about the same age, right?
Yeah, we are. But I didn't go to really down that rabbit hole till 2005.
Okay, so that's way later.
Yeah, that's way later than you. Yeah.
So maybe never had a point where Tenryu was considered, where people got war tapes for juniors matches.
No.
That was absolutely a thing that was happening when these shows were happening.
I mean, I was certainly aware of that, when I was coming in and sort of looking around and reading stuff. I saw the DVDBR, rankings of 90s stuff, which I think reflected that. So I mean, I was certainly aware that that had been the case, but no, I mean, by the time I came in, that would not have been the dominant viewpoint, I don't think.
Right. Cause certainly at some point, all of us got war shows for Ultimo Dragon matches.
And I've read your write-ups of the early Schneider comp, so I'm well aware that you've had your own journey.
Yeah, sir, exactly. It's not that I'm proud of, but look, we've all had things we've believed at some point that haven't been true.
Exactly. And
yeah, so at that point, I think people – because, you know, I think so many people when this was going on were captivated with the sort of precision of All Japan professional wrestling – heavyweights and New Japan professional wrestling juniors, you know, that stuff was so precise.
Right.
And so, you know, executed so, you know, in a way that just you had never seen anything like that. And then I think the sort of rougher edges of what Tenryu did, I think at least when it was going on amongst the people in America who were getting tapes from Japan, was less appreciated. Because you were sort of instead more captivated with how, you know, how well produced and well put together a Kawada Misawa match was, or a Kobashi match, a Steve Williams match, or something. And Tenryu was always going to do an enziguri that didn't look very good, or a powerbomb that looked kind of dropped him. You know what I mean? There's always parts of that of Tenryu's game. And now, you know, I could not care less that Tenryu doesn't have Christopher Daniels' execution. Execution has been something that's been defined down, right? Like, you could go to any random Canadian smash show and see some guys who execute things well.
Sure.
You know, like your opening six-man scramble on a random Ohio indie is going to have people executing things pretty good. And that just means so much less now to me as a fan. I just don't care whether it's executed well.
Yeah.
All right, should we move on to our last match?
Yeah, I think we hit the high points on that one, right? Okay.
So this is Preston Quinn versus Scotty Blaze. I was doing some searching for what a date for this was. I could not find the date exactly. I'm guessing it was around summer 2005. It was definitely the summer because I was
just saying we know from the commentary it was summer, right?
And I was at this.
You were at this. Okay.
Okay. And it was hot as fucking balls. Like, it was brutally, brutally, because it was outdoors, and it was, like, brutally hot. Like, one of those, you know, you're from this area. You live in Maryland. Yep. So you know how much summers in the Washington, D.C. metro area are like. And this was one of those. So it was just, like, you were just, you know, your socks were covered in sweat. Your, like, underwear was drenched, and it was just miserable.
Well, the commentary focused fairly heavily on whether or not they were getting bugs in their mouth as they were working. So that gives you some idea.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. I think I was getting bugs in my eyes when I was watching this match. So it's a match I imagine you have not seen this before, right?
I don't think so, no.
No, and it's a match I don't think I've seen since I watched it live, you know, 11 years ago. Which seems like it's crazy. It was that long ago, all right, well, so I'm fast. I thought this held up tremendously well on rewatch, but I obviously had very fond memories of watching this match live. So I'm interested in somebody who doesn't have you didn't have a particular history with either of these guys.
No, I mean, I've probably watched a fair amount of Preston Quinn just because he was a guy that you all pimped so heavily. And so that made me look him up. And I mean, I've always enjoyed him. I mean, I think he has absolutely tremendous offense. I mean, I just think all of his shit looks fantastic. And that was the case in this match. I wasn't as excited about Scotty Blaze. And I guess what I didn't love about the match is that it felt like one chunk of one guy being on offense and then another chunk of the other guy being on offense and then another chunk. It didn't feel... I didn't feel like there was a lot of fight or competition within the control segments. It felt very, you know, the control segments felt very binary to me. So I guess that left me a little bit wanting. But I always I particularly like watching Preston Quinn. So it wasn't like I didn't enjoy it, and I enjoyed the atmosphere and, you know, that sense of the heat and everything. I don't know if it would have made any difference to me if I had known the booking of the promotion better. I don't know.
I don't think there was much.
Probably not really, right?
No, no. It was a guy. Yeah. This guy's got a belt. This other guy wants a belt back. Yeah. Was the basic booking of that. I really like Scotty Blaze's offense. I always thought he had really – I love his like – I loved – like he has a couple of moves I just haven't seen before. I love the I'm going to put a chin lock on you. The, what he calls the gangster lean where he basically does the chin lock as a avalanche splash.
Yeah.
I always remember loving that when he did it back then. I think it's such a cool idea. It really does look like it hurts because he's a big, big, fat guy diving his full weight on your back in a really awkward way.
Yeah.
I think he's got a really great-looking curb stop for the same reason. Like it's a, this is a guy who's 325 pounds or something like that stepping on your head. I mean, it was a match that you watched to watch Preston Quinn punch somebody in the face.
I mean, that was the thing. I just wasn't sure that I bought him beating Preston Quinn.
I mean, you don't think that – I don't know. His stuff looked – his stuff – he hit hard.
Yeah, he did. His stuff looked fine. I don't know. It just – they just seemed like two wrestlers of different quality to me, which is fine.
I have really fond memories of watching this match. And I remember that it was one of those things where every shot from both guys – you know, thudded in a way that even stiff, you know, like there was a fair amount of stiff juniors wrestling that, you know, we have shows I think you were probably going with too as well, like ROH stuff,
sure.
You know, low key matches. And there's something different about a 150 pound guy kicking a guy stiff and like a 300 pound guy, like, thumping a guy in the chest with a forearm. You know, just like the difference between heavyweight boxing and middleweight boxing. You know what I mean? There's still something on knockout blows. And I remember watching this live, and that's what I really felt was, man, these are a pair of guys who are pounding each other.
Yeah.
And who are just laying leather. And Quinn, you know, also has amazing looking stuff that isn't, you know, three quarters legit, right? I mean, I don't think any of his punches are punches that are going to end up with a guy with a sore jaw the next day, but he's got an amazing array of them.
No, I mean, he's got Jerry Lawler, Dick Murdoch punches. He doesn't have Yuki Ishikawa punches, right?
I mean, you know, Blaze's stuff, I thought more felt like a guy who was actually, you know, when he hit you, those did feel like they were, you were, there was ribs being soared up. And oxygen, you know, and breath being left. Whereas Quinn, I thought, really was, yeah, as he had more Dick Murdoch Lawler stuff, which looked great. Also, I, you know, the double team demolition of the finish that match when the old school Empire ran in,
yeah,
and beat up that double team demolition decapitation thing was so awesome looking.
Yeah.
Like, that really should have been.
No, it was.
That really should have been. Somebody should have stolen that as a finisher.
Excuse me. Now, did these guys wrestle each other a lot over?
I think they did, yeah.
Because I know the commentary was referencing them matching up again.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. And Damian Wayne had a bunch of matches with Scotty Blaze, too, that were really great. At some point, I mean, I think Tim Knowles got these things on VHS tapes. And at some point, maybe there has to be just a project to get these on YouTube. I think Phil Ripa, my buddy 4-0, was one who put this up on YouTube. And I think he kind of found a DVD of it or something. It was like, oh, this should probably be on YouTube so people could watch it. It's only got about 80 views. So people should really go watch this match. It's really, for something that, you know, has 80 views on YouTube, and outside of those 80 people, there was 50 people at the show. For a match that only 100 people have ever watched.
Now,
this may not be as good as Ojito Santo, Negro Casas versus Scorpio Jr., Bestial Savate for Hairs and Mask Arena Mexico, but for a match only 100 people have ever watched, it's really great.
Now, why did Preston Quinn never sort of get beyond where he did? I mean, did he want to, or like what was the deal there?
He works, or I don't know whether his style is something that trans. Where would he go? Where would his fit be?
I guess that's right. I guess he was just a man. He was kind of a man out of time, right?
Yeah, exactly. He would have been amazing in Mid-Atlantic in 1982, but where would he have been in 2005?
Well, like he didn't even go and work in like IWA Mid-South, right? I mean, like he would have fit in.
Imagine he has a job in Richmond, Virginia.
Yeah, yeah.
That doesn't allow him to travel around. I mean, he still wrestles.
Yeah.
There's a really good match with him working as like a Charlie Brown from out of town masked gimmick. It's Damian Wayne earlier this year. which only goes about 8 minutes to 9 minutes. It's kind of a BS ending, but it's got the same kind of like, oh man, this guy feel to what this is. I think this might be his best available footage match. I don't know if there's a better one that's out there. There's a really good Damian Wayne match, which I bought from NWA Fusion's Vimeo site. But outside of that, I don't think there's a lot. I mean, this is a guy who's been really great for a really long time and has very, very little of his career available to see.
I think he's looked fantastic in anything I've ever seen him in.
Yeah, he's great. He really is great. And I'm going to come in here as a much bigger fan of Scotty Blaze than you too. I thought this in this period in 2005 that he was a guy who was as a foil for these guys, for Quinn and Wayne and Mike Booth, who were all really great wrestlers. I thought he was a great foil. That's kind of a guy who I think it always worked heel in his career before this, and was kind of working as like a Dusty Rhodes-ish babyface against your Mid-Atlantic Mid-Atlantic indie version of the Four Horsemen, was really, really great in that role.
Yeah, and I mean, don't get me wrong, I liked him fine as a big hard-hitting guy. It was just one of those things where I enjoy watching Quinn so much that I kept sort of rooting for Quinn to get back on offense.
Understandable.
You know those kinds of matches. It's just like...
yeah. All right. So this is the part of the show where we dig in the crates for something that doesn't have anything to do with professional wrestling. We pick something, whether it's a movie, a book, a television show, a song, an app, a theology, a political theory, you know, a recipe, whatever it is. And it could be anything. And recommend that people don't know about it, they should check it out. So I'll go first. I think everybody, certainly of people who are our age, probably spent the last like week sort of engrossed with Prince's death. I think that really, really sort of gut punched almost everybody of a certain age and older. I don't know if it meant a lot to 22-year-olds, but people in their 30s and 40s, I think it meant a ton too. So I've done a lot of like watching, you know, tributes on YouTube, and I rewatched Purple Rain the other day. When was the last time you saw Purple Rain?
It's probably been
great for Purple Rain, but for a second, when was the last time you saw Purple Rain?
It's probably been 10 years.
It's a pretty good movie.
Yeah, it is.
There's parts of it that, in the current era that we live in, seem very off. I made my wife Chelsea watch Purple Rain maybe a year and a half ago, and there were some issues in the way that women are treated that she had some real problems with. I think there's a point where Morris Day just dumps a girl into a has Jerome throw a girl into a dumpster, laugh, like ha ha, look, throw this girl in the dumpster. Ta-da. And there's a certain like Prince doesn't treat his girlfriend very nicely.
No, he doesn't.
Although this is a bit of an aside. The one flaw I kind of found with the film storytelling is the plot of Purple Rain is basically that Prince is playing a fictionalized version of himself with his band. And he has like the hero's journey of overcoming, he's at the beginning of the movie, he's doing this stuff that people aren't into, the promoter's going to drop him from the bill, and he's, you know, acting out, and he eventually gets it together and then performs these amazing songs at the end. But the problem is all the stuff at the beginning is also Prince performances of Prince. So I don't really understand why you could watch Prince perform Let's Go Crazy and not be amazingly enraptured by that, and how we're supposed to understand that as being somehow different and worse than a performing Baby I'm a Star at the end of the movie.
Well, and this is a guy who was widely recognized, at least critically, as a genius when he was still a teenager, right? So this is not a guy who faced enormous adversity in the context of great performers throughout history, right?
Right. Yeah. When the promoter goes, people don't like you. People don't like your music, and you kind of go, I don't know. I think they probably do. They seem to. It doesn't make any sense as part of a story that people don't like this stuff earlier. There doesn't seem to be any quality difference between his performances at the beginning of the movie and at the end of the movie. I guess his performance of Darling Nikki is kind of an asshole move to his girlfriend, but also would, if I saw it live, he'd be amazed by it. So that's my comment on Purple Rain. I'm not recommending Purple Rain to you, although if for some reason you haven't seen Purple Rain. I think
by all means.
Yeah, all means, go see that movie. So I am going to recommend a musician who I think is sort of the most Prince-ish of sort of the new sort of wave of R&B guys. There's a lot of like current R&B music, which is very sort of different than the way R&B was when we grew up, and sort of more the line of it is they call it like PBR&B, which is a terrible name, but our indie R&B, which is also sort of a terrible name. So this is Gallant. Have you ever heard of Gallant?
I don't think I have, actually.
Okay. This is a crate digger a little bit. He released his first album. It was called Ology, O-L-O-G-Y. That came out maybe 3 weeks ago. And it's really, really great. He's doing some kind of cool thing. He had a really, really sort of well-received performance at Coachella a couple weeks ago. So this is somebody who's of the moment. I really like this album. I've been listening to it all. Was listening to it a lot before Prince died, and then have really been mixing it in with replaying Purple Rain over and over again since he died. So I'm going to play a little bit of Weight Gold, which is the first single off this sort of single. I don't know if singles are a thing that exists anymore, but this was like one of the first songs that he got leaked on the internet before this album came out. This is the album version of it. There's also a pretty amazing version where he does like a live version with Seal, where he pulls a Seal out of a cryo chamber somewhere, and they sort of do a duet on this. That's also worth looking up if you like this version of the song. That's Weight and Gold. Gallant. The album's Ology. It's available where things are available. So I would recommend checking that out. I would also recommend checking out the version of that song he did with Seal, which is also really awesome. All right, Childs, what is your non-wrestling recommendation?
Yeah, I'll get to it in a second. I did want to ask you one thing, spinning off of the Prince conversation. Did you feel like have you read anything, you know, since Prince died that kind of hit you in the gut or, you know, made you think or whatever about Prince? I've kind of been questing for something really good to read about Prince, and I haven't really hit anything yet. So I was just curious if you had seen anything that kind of.
I'm trying to think. I've heard some pretty good conversations about it.
Yeah.
I thought the New York Times the podcast the New York Times music writers did was really good. I thought Wesley Morris talked to Bill Simmons about it.
Yeah,
I was like listening to hear what he has to say. I don't know if I've read anything great.
Yeah.
So that's actually a good if you find something. I've read some fine things, but I don't know if I've read anything that's like blown me away.
Yeah, I guess maybe because that's maybe because I'm a writer. I guess when something like this happens, I always want to find that piece that kind of hits me right in the sweet spot, and I feel like I haven't in this case. And I've been looking. So no, I was just curious. But
people in the comment section of this podcast recommend us Prince obituary writing that we should read.
Yeah,
it feels like it has to have been written.
Gotta be something.
There are enough people, really, really good writers, who write about culture and music in this world that somebody really has to have, you know, nailed that. But you're right. I haven't read it. I don't know if you D'Angelo did. Sometimes It Snows in April on the Tonight Show.
Yeah, I saw that
last night. That was the best. That wasn't writing, but man alive, that was what that was. Especially the part where he kind of breaks down. That was the one that kind of lumped your throat a little bit.
Well, D'Angelo is an amazing talent. I mean, I feel like his released music isn't always the most focused.
Sure.
But his talent is undeniable.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, I would say that would be the other guy that I think Gallant really reminds me of too.
Yeah.
Is D'Angelo. That's kind of very much the D'Angelo vibe that album is doing.
Except for if D'Angelo did it, it would be 9 minutes long.
Yeah, I give about a minute 20 of it, but that song does come in at a solid 3:25, so you're in and out.
Right.
Yeah.
That song didn't need to last for 9 minutes.
You know, it's kind of the same way I feel about a lot of wrestling matches.
Exactly.
Right? You want a good 3-minute 35-second song, you want a good 16-minute wrestling match.
Precisely. But
podcasts, you'd like those to be 9 hours, but and everything else.
I will never do that again. but anyway, I think the thing that I'm going to talk about is also music. And have you heard the band Wussy at all?
Wussy.
Wussy. Yes.
Okay. No, you think they have something on Apple Music that I can play?
Probably. They've been around for a long time. They've been around for, I think, at least 10 years. It's a Cincinnati band. Two singers, a man and a woman, Chuck and Lisa, and they dated for a long time and they broke up, but the band stayed together. So that was a good thing. And I guess I would describe it as sort of. Almost a perfect amalgamation between like alt country and shoegazing.
Okay, those are both things I like.
Yeah, and yet the songs are catchy and concise, and you know pack a lot of emotional wallop. And actually, I saw them in DC, and it was a tiny room in DC maybe a month ago.
What club? Regional.
It's what's it called?
U Street Music Hall.
No, it's not. It was a place I'd never been before. It's like something upstairs. I mean, it's literally like a row house with a room at the top where they have a tiny stage and a bar.
I know exactly the place you're talking about. No, I can't remember the name.
Yeah, I just can't remember the name. But they're actually coming back. They're going to be at the Black Hat in July. So maybe that's something to look at. But
holler at your boy.
But yeah, that's a.
All right, what song should I play here? I've got some stuff loaded up.
What do you have?
I mean, it looks like they've had they have 8 albums on iTunes. So I should be able to get their top results are Dropping Houses, Attica, Beautiful, Teenage Wasteland, which I would assume would be the
that's probably a cover. You can play Dropping Houses. That's kind of the quasi single off of their newest record, which came out this year. So you could play that.
All right. Let's hear a little of it. Very cool. That was Dropping Houses by Wussy off Forever Sounds. I liked it. It reminded me a lot of the kind of stuff I was listening to in my 20s in D.C. It had that very much feel of like a band that might have been on, I guess it was on Matador. So it feels like kind of band that would be on Matador. Might be a little of Mile Marker. I don't know if that's a band you've ever heard of.
Yeah.
But it had that same sort of like one girl singing, one guy singing over her kind of thing that I always thought was really cool when they did it. I thought sounded really good here. I'm in.
All right.
So, yeah. Well, that is a solid right over 1 hour podcast. In and out. That's the way we like to do it here on this particular show on the Place to Be Nation. You get in, we recommend a bunch of wrestling matches you should watch, recommend some other cool things you should be in on, and then let you move on with your life. people want to check out Childs, they can listen to that podcast. That's also on Place to Be, right?
Yes.
What is actually the name of it?
That is Wrestling with the Past.
Wrestling with the Past?
Yep.
If you're interested in a podcast that's about as long as all three of the Indiana Jones movies. Longer. Maybe longer.
Easily longer.
You can check that out. Also, what's your Twitter?
At Charles Walker.
And they could. Do you have a place where people could easily find your writing at the Baltimore Sun?
You could just search my name in Baltimore Sun.
Okay. Would you have anything? What would you say would be the most interesting thing that you've written for the Baltimore Sun in 2016 if people were going to read one piece of writing you did?
Oh, don't put me on the spot like that.
Come on. This is your chance. Pimp your
2016, spot. Man? I don't know.
You know, one piece. Do you like, oh, this is an interesting, different thing I got a chance to do? It wasn't me just doing game. You had to have written something. I know that I've read some things.
I'm actually drawing a blank. That's terrible. I can't even promote myself.
What was the last big feature you did? You did the last one if you can't think of the best one.
Last big feature I did.
We're not getting off the podcast until, but this will go. We'll go another 8 hours.
You just squeeze the shit out of me. It's been a weird time because I kind of haven't been with any one team. I mean, if you have any interest in baseball history, I did a long piece commemorating the 1966 Orioles team, which won the first championship in franchise history. This is baseball season just started, so this was a big piece in our season preview section. So that was. I guess you could do that.
All right, that sounds great. We will put a link to your 1966. You said,
yeah, 66.
1966 Baltimore Orioles history piece. That sounds exactly like I am much more interested in baseball of the 60s than I am in baseball of the current era. So I will check that out.
Probably not really up your alley in any respect, though.
My friend, I used to be a big baseball fan when I was a little kid, so I probably will recognize more names on that Orioles team than I would recognize on the current Orioles team.
Although it does heavily feature Frank Robinson, who is from your neck of the woods. So
there you go. I'm in.
There you go.
All right. Thanks a lot, Childs. I really enjoyed doing this. We'll have to do once I start recycling through. I don't have that many people I know who.
What's you say? What's a 5-man rotation, pretty much?
Yeah, probably about that. So I imagine that if I'm doing these more often, you'll be back sooner than later.
Sounds good.
All right, buddy. And you don't stop, I keep on. 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 And you don't stop, I keep on.
Yo, praise the Lord for showbiz. My partner with the beats, with the Nikes on his feet. Buying old records is a habit. I get more run than a Volkswagen Rabbit. You know I gotta have it. I got more props than the cop called McGarrett, who played on Hawaii Vivo and I formed a production company with Show. And J Studio is the lab. But the session is closed, cause I know you got a big nose. Try to sniff out the name. You lack originality and that's a damn shame. Don't front, I know I got you open like a pack of tokens. Yo, I put your coat in. I'm not the one to be gamed on. I didn't know it was your girl we ran the train on. But no hard feelings, your girl was appealing. Did my share of dealing, sexual healing. You didn't know she was a groupie, but I'ma put you up on the scoopie. Used to live in Forest, my daughter lives on Morris. Used to play softball with my man Horace. I kick flavor like my man Sonny Chiba. Aries is my sign, I'm compatible with Libra. I like the program beats. Diamond D is out, I wanna say pay. Showbiz, there's deals to make. So let's get busy and dig in the crates.
I don't stop, you keep on digging in the crates.
Let's get busy.
Keep on
digging in the crate.
Yo, thank the law for Diamond D. No afro instead, he keeps dreads in his head. My partner from the past, from 163rd back when I was a hoodlum, beating on nerds. It started
way back when?
About 12 years ago, I was 9, he was 10. Before smoking weed and hanging out and playing hooky, we used to break dance in the jams, electric boogie. Girls watch jockin', my nickname is Rockin'. The crowd, I was shocking. Freaks, I was clocking. Step up and see showbiz performing. My beats hit hard
like Big George Foreman.
So MCs and DJs who thought they were nice and get upset like Busta did to Tyson. That wasn't the plan, and he's still my man since he beat up Miss Green outside Dapper Dan. Wait a minute, that's a different subject. Talk about the Moet and the Pipers, that's in effect. Back to the show. The show B-I-Z down with D-I-T-C. A-G is my MC, relying on the giant. The giant are relying, never crying for the crack, cause I'm not a crack client. Girls stick like crazy glue, they think they're getting dope, but I treat hoes like drugs, I just say no. I lamp in a residence, so keeping dead presidents a fact. I like my pockets fat, not flat. A rapper, not a singer, so hook it, don't bring her. Problem to me, so go ahead, you humdinger. Show's about to blow in 91, so I'm straight down with the crew caught digging in the crates.
Stop, you keep on
digging it. In the crate.
So get back, get your sticks and get your bats. Get your licks and I'ma still get fat. Try to diss and get the back hand. I'm dressed in black, a black hat for a black man. The giant is better and clever. Go ahead and sleep and you'll rest forever and ever. I'm like a bomb, sometimes I'm calm. No telling what can happen once the mic is in my right palm. Me and showbiz too deep, but don't sleep. Go ahead and retreat or face agony of defeat. AG is in command. You remember the black hat and the bottom of my Timberland. Save it. If you think you pose a threat, just chill and watch how many hoes I get. Now you sweat the props I got.
Kick a rhyme.
A rhyme? Sure, why not? Always get fat to a hype track. So finesse.
What's up?
Psych, give me that mic back. The crowd I'll capture. Microphone master. Finger licking and kicking lyrics from here to Africa. I'm the bold kind. My rhymes are gold mine. Let it off. Set it off just for old times. Think you're ready for this? You wanna battle? Your music is riddle rattle. Your rhymes are scribble scrabble. The giant is greater, so I'm great. Down with the group called Digging in the Crates.
Yeah, yeah. We gon' set it off like this.
D-I-T-C.
Now when it comes to lyrics, mics I pulverize. It's law finesse, time to go for mine. So stand back, let the men play. I put rhymes in shape just like Bengay. I'm great and honorable, suckers I bomb a few. I run more games than a carnivore, I'ma get mine. As soon as you say start, sweat hoods and funky rhymes is my trademark. I'ma get fame, not from her or his name. Cause yo,
what's up?
I'm funkin' in a shit stain. Mics I smoke, rhymes I hurl. My hobby is collecting fly looking girls. Strictly for the ladies, call me Lord Finesse. And I'm all about money and sex. Finesse is the name to say. And I came to play. We could have fun, but put the whips and chains away. Sex and money is what makes me a happy man. And I sport more styles than Jackie Chan. I keep rising, I'm not the type to sink low. Me take a loss on a mic? I don't think so. Lord Finesse is out to make tapes. Down with the crew called digging in the crates.